Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 3. Hiranyakashipu's plan to be immortal. Text 34. Anantavyaktarupena yene dam akilang tatang chirachich chakti yuktaya tasmai bhagavate namaha anantavyakta rupena yene dam akilam tatam chirachich chakti yuktaya tasmai bhagavate namaha anantavyakta rupena yene dam akilam tatam chirachich chakti yuktaya tasmai bhagavate namaha. Vaishnavis, Ananta avyakta rupena, by the unlimited, unmanifested form, yena, by which, idam, this, akiram, total aggregate, tatam, expanded, chit, with spiritual, achit, and material, shakti, potency, yuktaya, unto he who is endowed, tasmai, unto him, bhagavate, unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Nama, I offer my respectful obeisances. Translation. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the Supreme, who in his unlimited, unmanifested form has expanded the cosmic manifestation, the form of the totality of the universe. He possesses external and internal energies, and the mixed energy called the marginal potency, which consists of all the living entities. Purport. The Lord is endowed with unlimited potencies, parasha shakti vividaiva shruyate, which are summarized as three, namely external, internal, and marginal. The external potency manifests this material world, the internal potency manifests the spiritual world, and the marginal potency manifests the living entities, who are mixtures of internal and external. The living entity, being part and parcel of Parabrahman, is actually internal potency. But because of being in contact with the material energy, he is an emanation of material and spiritual energies. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is above the material energy and is engaged in spiritual pastimes. The material energy is only an external manifestation of his pastimes. Om Ganachimadandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chokshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Let us begin by saying, so we don't forget, Haranyakashipu is offering these prayers not to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but to Lord Brahma. And that is an extraordinary mistake. Because, as you know, Brahma is the topmost personality within the material cosmos. But he is not the cause of all causes. He's the engineer. He takes the ingredients given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Brahma's own body and intelligence and abilities are coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But guess what? Hiranyakashipu doesn't care about that. What does he want? Power. He is on the ultimate power trip. And he doesn't care how he gets it. So it really doesn't matter to him who is the source of everything, who's the cause of all causes. He's got his mind fixed on power. And he knows if through yogic austerities he can influence Lord Brahma, then he gets the power. He's just performed austerities that are unparalleled in the material cosmos. And as a result, Lord Brahma has come to fulfill his requests. So, remember when Lord Brahma first appeared, after Hiranyakashipu's extraordinarily long and severe austerities, Hiranyakashipu paid his full dandavats on the ground, shivering in ecstasy. Now, that shivering in ecstasy was not transcendental. The shivering in ecstasy was because I have achieved my quest, the goal I've been trying to get. I'm going to get power. Brahma is here. He's going to make me immortal. Now, why was Hiranyakashipu so hung up about immortality? Well, actually, any intelligent person in this world, materially speaking, not speaking spiritually, but any materially intelligent person in this world is concerned about death. Sometimes psychologists say that behind everyone's insecurity is this fear that death can come. And in order to cope with that, you have to absorb yourself in forgetfulness. Become a workaholic, become an alcoholic, become a something-aholic, so you don't have to think about it. Plunge into sense gratification with this one, that one, all so you can escape the reality of your impending death. A materially intelligent person is actually aware that my end can come at any moment. That's not spiritual intelligence. That's material intelligence. So Hiranyakashipu being the shrewdest of the shrewd. He was not only the smartest guy in the room, materially speaking, he was the smartest guy in the whole material universe. Materially the smartest. But is that enough? He's going to be so thwarted by his little boy, Prahlad. In spite of Hiranyakashipu's unchallenged power, his little boy, his own son, is going to drive him over the brink to the point where Hiranyakashipu wants to kill him. So now Lord Brahma has appeared before Hiranyakashipu, who's trembling and shivering in ecstasy, and he's offering all these prayers. You are the supreme. You are it. You are the one. In other words, you're going to do it for me. He's not offering prayers unconditionally. He knows it's payoff time, big time. That's why he's shivering in ecstasy. He knows that Brahma can give me what I want. But then he was a little taken aback because Brahma told him, you know, I can't give immortality. It's not possible. So Hiranyakashipu, sharp as he was, did a quick calculation. He's the master of calculation. Oh, can't give me immortality, but there is a way through the back door. And as you'll hear in coming days, he's going to make a whole list of requests to Brahma, which, according to Hiranyakashipu's mind, add up to immortality. This is how clever he thinks he is. He's so impressed by his own intelligence. So, Brahma has given him a hint that you're calling me the best of the givers of benediction. Varadottama is the Sanskrit term. It's always educational to pay attention to the nomenclature in Sanskrit, the names that are being used, because they're of deep import. In today's verse, Hiranyakashipu is referring to Brahma as Bhagavan. You are the supreme. But, of course, that's a misapplied title. And he also referred to Brahma, as we said, as Varadottama, best of the givers of benediction. Hint, hint. Get ready. Here come my requests. Now, Brahma is going to warn Hiranyakashipu that material benedictions are actually burdensome. Brahma is the creator of the universe. He knows that it's difficult to perform austerities to become materially empowered. Of course, Brahma's empowerment comes from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Nevertheless, as you know from the beginning of Bhagavatam, Brahma performed austerities. And in that way, he pleased the Supreme Personality of Godhead through his divine austerities, not material austerities. So Brahma is warning Hiranyakashipu. He's giving him fair advance warning. Look, you know, material benedictions are a heavy load to carry. They're difficult to attain, but they're also difficult to maintain. In other words, the benedictions that you're asking for, because they're material, they're high maintenance. Think about that. High maintenance. Hiranyakashipu wasn't thinking about that. He had his plan. Give me these benedictions so no one can interfere with me. This is the heart of our spirit of material enjoyment. Now, when you hear about Hiranyakashipu, please don't just push him out of your range of self-analysis, like, oh, he was so evil. He was really out there. I'm not so bad, you know. When I speak at programs around the world, to outreach programs, I often get the people to recite a mantra indicating what we're all thinking, that actually we're not so bad. What's the mantra? All I want is blank. Therefore, I'm okay. All I want is this. All I want is that. What's the problem? I don't have unlimited material desires. I'm not like Hiranyakashipu trying to control the universe. All I want is, and that way we let ourselves off the hook. See? I may not be the most saintly person, but I'm not the worst. All I want is, and we justify ourselves in that way. But let's not push Hiranyakashipu out of our range completely. There's no doubt he's a special demon. He's not a demon by situation. He's not a demon by association. He is a demon actually because of a special divine arrangement. And that's why he's so empowered. He's going to give the Supreme Personality of Godhead pleasure through fighting with him. His brother, who's dead now, has already done that here in Yaksha. And Hiranyakashipu can't get that out of his mind. Vishnu killed my brother. He did something real sneaky. He took a form of a boar, and he killed my brother. So day and night, Hiranyakashipu is meditating on this. And that meditation, amazingly enough, is going to continue even after Hiranyakashipu gets control of the whole universe. Now, this shows you something, that no matter how much power, control, and material enjoyment you get, there's always some hang-up that you can't get out of your mind. And he was traumatized by Vishnu's killing his brother. And he held on to that. He wouldn't get over it. Although he had unrivaled material power and enjoyment, he couldn't get that out of his heart and out of his head. So he maintained that animosity against Vishnu. Of course, the ultimate cause of his predicament is that actually he is a devotee. But he's become so demoniac that even Narada Muni, later in the seventh canto, when referring to demons like Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha, Narada Muni is going to say, "Oh, how great they are. If only I had a spirit of devotion, of bhakti that matches their anger and resentment of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. How lively and intense my bhakti would be." This shows how a devotee can learn from anything. We can look at anything in this world, and if we've been properly trained in bhakti vision, we can see inspiration for our determination and patience. So Narada Muni sets the classic example. These classic demons like Shishupal, Hiranyakashipu, they were so absorbed in thinking about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Of course, it was all unfavorable, but let's put that aside for a while, Narada Muni is implying. It's antagonistic, it's unfavorable, but look at the intensity. That's what we want to focus on. Because real bhakti is about intensity. That's what attracts Krishna's attention. So Hiranyakashipu thinks that I'll package my requests for material benedictions in such a way that I'll avoid my obvious fears. What are his obvious fears? Think how he calculates. Who just killed my brother? It was Vishnu. Now, how did Vishnu sneak attack my brother? He took the form of an animal. Okay, Brahma, grant me that no animal will kill me. That takes care of Varaha. What about the wrath of saintly persons? Hiranyakashipu is aware of that, too. How did Maharaj Vena die? He was cursed by saintly persons. So, Hiranyakashipu is thinking, who's the topmost sadhu in the universe I know? Bhrigu Muni. I have to make sure that he won't nail me with one of his Brahmana curses. How do I do that? Brahma, grant me the power that is unrivaled in the whole universe. I'll have more power than any living entity in the universe. That means even Bhrigu can't touch me with his curses. Okay. Then, Vishnu's got that Sudarshan chakra. That's a bit of a concern. How do we deal with that? Brahma, grant me the benediction that I'll be killed by no weapon. Okay, I've got everything covered practically. I just make some more requests that I can't be killed by anyone in the universe, anyone from anywhere in the universe. So he really thought Brahma couldn't make me immortal, but Brahma, assisted by my sublime, unlimited intelligence, has actually made me immortal. So now, Hiranyakashipu has fulfilled his power trip in terms of getting all that he wants. He had everything he wanted. That's a rare thing in the material world. Usually, you have material desires, but they're rarely completely fulfilled. But in the case of Hiranyakashipu, he becomes the primary example of someone who has everything and yet is still dissatisfied. He becomes a very fascinating example for current civilization, because Hiranyakashipu is showing that, all right, you don't have my powers, you don't have my material abilities, but the basic bottom line is still the same. As long as you can't control your senses, you won't be satisfied. That's what Hiranyakashipu is showing through his example. Obviously, he's not thinking about that example. He's indulging in his power, but he's actually showing that example for individuals, for society, that you can have everything, but if you cannot control your senses, dissatisfaction will always be there in your life. I like the way Srila Prabhupada explains it in one of his purports later in the seventh canto, that you may well indeed expand technology. You may well indeed expand material convenience. You can do that, but guess what? It won't affect your dissatisfaction. This is a very, very deep insight. You are free to make your technology. You are free to make your material luxuries. You can do that. You can spend your whole human form of life trying to be comfortable. You have that option. But you won't be satisfied. So this is the lesson that Hiranyakashipu is giving, although he doesn't intend to. He's going to incur the wrath of every dignified person in the cosmos. He's outrageous because he knows no one can check me. There's only three personalities who can interfere with me, and they won't. Brahma won't do anything. He's the one who gave me the benedictions. Brahma doesn't, take action against demons. Shiva, he won't bother me. And Vishnu, he doesn't. He's not going to be concerned because I've already made a barrier with all those benedictions from Brahma. So basically, I'm free to harass everyone. This is the demoniac spirit. I'm free to act in any way I like without concern for other human beings, without concern for other species, without concern for future generations. Wonderful. According to Freud, every human being would actually like to act in this way. Of course, Freud was an atheistic materialist, and he hypothesized that material happiness means unbridled sensual urges. That's what every human being would actually like to do, and that's the only way human beings can be happy. But Freud recognized that human beings can't act in that way. This is the tragedy in his eyes. If each human being simply acts on their instantaneous animal urges, how can we have a peaceful society? We'll have a jungle. We'll have chaos. He was able to recognize that. So he said, therefore, in order to have a well-ordered or even partially ordered human society, each human being, each member of the society agrees to sacrifice his happiness, her happiness. Remember, for him, happiness is unbridled indulgence. But society can't go on when everyone acts in that way, even though that is their real constitutional position, and that is their real Baba, but it can't happen. Therefore, you sacrifice your natural happiness for the sake of society, so society can go on. And that's why you're always troubled. You're always hung up about things because you can't act according to your natural constitutional position, which is just unbridled sense enjoyment. Hiranyakashipu had the opportunity to act in that way, and he didn't care about anyone. He shows in high relief. He shows in boldface type what is the monster that's lurking within us. What is that monster? That I don't care about sustainable happiness. I just want to please myself right now. Don't try to educate me about my happiness footprint. In other words, how my attempts to be happy affect others, other human beings, the environment, future generations. That's not my concern. Often it's said that people today live in such a way that they consider the debts they have to their predecessors, their ancestors. I want to please grandfather. I want to please grandmother or mother and father. They gave me these instructions. They gave me an inheritance. In good families, tradition is very important. This is our family way of doing things. Grandfather would have, if he were present now, he would have wanted me to act in a certain way. So, in good traditional families, you consider your debt you owe to your predecessors. But, actually, that's not the complete picture. As people are starting to wake up today, understand, why should we act now in such a way to jeopardize future generations? We can't just look backwards and I've got to pay my debt to grandfather. What about your great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren coming in the future? What kind of world will they inherit from you? Why are you destroying their resources, ruining their future? Just like now in the USA, for the first time, it's happening in the past 10 years, the younger generation can't look ahead to having a better life than their parents. They can't even look ahead to having an equal life, materially speaking, as their parents. So this is a real shake-up for the American dream. It has been ingrained decade after decade, that things will get better and better and better. Each generation will have more than the preceding generation. The technology will be better. The education will be better. The universities will get better and better. It just keeps on going on like that. More and more opportunity. As democracy gets better and better, more people have more and more equal rights and more wealth to share and on, the dream goes. But now it's not happening like that. Now, people did acknowledge that there are bumps in the road. But the American dream was always that the bumps in the road last a few years. That's all. And they test what you're made of. If you're really a rugged, individualistic American, you can handle a few years of tough times because you know. The general trend is everything is going up. Things are just going to get better and better. But now people are having to face the reality. Where is that dream? We're falling back. Materially, we're falling back. We graduate from the university and we have to live with our parents. We can't afford our own residences because of the college loans, the burden is so great. I just saw some statistics from the U.S. Labor Department in which it said the majority of the 20 fastest growing jobs in the USA do not require a university degree. Yet, of course, the pressure is there. Go to the university. Go to the university. You'll improve. And everyone's finding out, for the most part, generally speaking, that you simply increase your debts because there's no guarantee when you graduate from school that you're going to get a job that will make it all work for you. So, what kind of happiness is it that considers our connection with all living entities? What kind of happiness is it that considers future generations? What kind of happiness is it that considers the environment? This is where the intelligence of the human being should be directed. Let us discuss what is sustainable happiness. Let us educate people in that way. Because then you have to start to consider, are my attempts at being happy affecting the quality of the air? Are my attempts to being happy loading up the earth with waste materials that won't break down for thousands of years? Are my attempts at being happy making life miserable for some other human beings? And are my attempts at being happy affecting other species? Am I destroying other species just for the satisfaction, for example, of my tongue? So this is what's called the happiness footprint. And of course, with the knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam, we can go deeper and deeper in our analysis. That it's not simply you are connected to other human beings. It's not even simply that you're connected to all species of life. It's not simply that you're connected to material nature. What is the ultimate source? Narada Muni, in the second canto of Bhagavatam, he appeared to be momentarily mesmerized by the power of his father, Lord Brahma. And he thought, perhaps my father is the ultimate. But then Narada Muni thought, he is focusing on someone else. He's meditating on someone else. There must be someone beyond my father, Brahma, the chief engineer, Adi Kavi, the original intellectual of the universe. There must be someone beyond him. Let's find out about that ultimate source, the ultimate connection. Now, here is what makes understanding Krishna, Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a little difficult. You see, on the one hand, everything is Krishna. But on the other hand, Krishna has his own unique individuality. He's more than the sum total of everything. He is the sum total of everything, and at the same time, he has a unique individual existence. So understanding nature, understanding the whole environment, even if you can do it, comprehend the whole universe, it's not enough. We must understand that unique individual who is the root of the universe. So there is this achincha beta beta tattva, this inconceivable simultaneous oneness and difference. The material nature has no existence separate or independent from Krishna. Yet at the same time, Krishna has his own unique individuality. Therefore, you cannot understand the ecosystem, you cannot understand the material universe, you cannot understand the unlimited material universes, unlimited because you can't get to the end, without understanding the ultimate source, the ultimate connection. And that ultimate source has unique individuality. So Krishna is indeed, as he said in Bhagavad Gita, difficult to understand unless you approach him his way. Just like if someone wants to understand you. We're such tiny living entities, but someone could have difficulty understanding us. What's your motivation? What are you really thinking? What agenda do you have? Reminds me, I had one aspiring disciple, someone in USA, he just told me, Guru Maharaj, I just can't understand you. He's like, you know, he's a young devotee, a new devotee. And so I told him, I'm sorry, but maybe it's good you don't understand me with, you know, with your, you know, a few months, you know, of bhakti practice. He didn't say it in an offensive way. He was like, you know, it was like an incredible realization to him that, wow, someone could be thinking in such a way that's beyond me. I never took that into account before. So, we can be misunderstood by others, and other persons can be difficult for us to understand them. Krishna in Bhagavad Gita presents his issues. People think, first I was impersonal, then I became personal. Or people think I'm an ordinary human being. They don't understand my supreme dominion over everything. People approach me the wrong way by going through the demigods, as Hiranyakashipu is doing. Krishna has a whole list of how he's misunderstood. He's a person, and he's explaining, these are the mistakes you make in understanding me. And then he also presents how you can come closer to him, and he'll also come closer to you. Obviously, Hiranyakashipu is not interested in coming close to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Brahma is good enough for him because Brahma is going to give the power. Another material philosopher from Germany theorized accurately that every human being is on a power trip. What you call normal material existence means you're trying to expand your power through time and space. So this is actually the Hiranyakashipu principle. But because we're small time at it, we think, oh, it's not so bad. Hiranyakashipu, he was out of it. He was just the ultimate limit of the power trip. But again, the mantra, all I want is... So how can I be that bad? I just want to squeeze some enjoyment out of this world, you know. I don't want to think all the time about what's the ultimate cause of all causes, and I'm spirit, soul, not the body. I can take that one day a week, you know, at the Sunday feast. But as a daily 24-hour-a-day reality, isn't that artificial? Won't my individuality and creativity be curtailed? This is a big fear in the USA. Don't tread on my individuality. Don't tread on my creativity. Don't fence me in. Don't try in any way to reduce my personal expression. So, think about it. What we call normal human interactions are the demonstration of the desire to control and enjoy. We call that innocent. It's like the example Prabhupada gave. I'm not a big thief. I'm just a small thief. So therefore, why worry about me? Look at the big thieves. That's what will actually solve human problems, when you corral all the big thieves. Even materially. That may not be so. In New York City, the police established a policy of zero tolerance. If you were walking on the street in New York and you just spit, a policeman was on you. So people were protesting like, wait a minute. We just made minor infractions. Spitting in the street or, you know, writing graffiti on the walls, you know, normal pastimes. And the police are on us, fining us. But then people watch that the crime rate in the whole city dropped dramatically. And the police got computers and they analyze where all the crimes are happening. And they basically were on top of everything. And people complained until they saw the crime rate drop. And so the police explained that this is obviously how you do it. You don't tolerate the small thieves. You don't tolerate the big thieves. But we want toleration for our small-time thievery. And Hiranyakashipu, we know he's a demon. But we, you know, are just trying to do what we can. And we hope in that way that our attempts to expand power through time and space will meet with cooperation. Right? Remember Kamsa? In Krishna Lila, when Kamsa was recruiting Akrura to aid his nefarious schemes to fetch Krishna and Balaram from Vrindavan, what did Kamsa do? First of all, he had a brand new chariot because he was thinking Vaishnavs are very simplistic and sentimental. You know, Vaishnavs are always caught up in this bhakti thing. Yeah. All right. What will blow the mind of a simple-minded Vaishnava like Akrura? Here's a brand new chariot, Akrura. You'll be the first one to ride on this Mercedes chariot. Don't you want to take it to Vrindavan and bring back Krishna and Balaram? You can be the first to take a ride. And what was Akrura thinking? Kamsa, I'm so glad you gave me a brand new chariot to go fetch Krishna and Balaram, because I would never want to bring them back on a chariot that you sat on, you demon. So this shows you the bhakti yogis are seeing one way and the dedicated materialists are seeing another way, even though they're looking at the same thing. So Kamsa explained his plan to Akrura. And you can see in that plan the same demoniac tendency coming out, but we also should recognize the pollutant in our own hearts. We're not as powerful as Kamsa, what to speak of Hiranyakashipu. Yet, this innocent, quote-unquote, desire to control and enjoy is what gets us body after body, material life after material life, and it ruins the happiness footprint. This is our job as servants of Lord Chaitanya to show how the happiness footprint of the world is ruined by this desire to control and enjoy. We need to analytically and scientifically present that because people are becoming concerned. What is sustainable happiness? Government leaders should understand what is sustainable happiness, how it can be that we can try to be happy without interfering with other human beings, with other species, with the environment, with future generations. We need to understand this. So then the question is, how deep do you want to go? How deeply do you want to understand the illusion that we're in? So we're not actually innocent. And this will be the first step forward in human progress, genuine human progress, if we understand we're actually not that innocent. And we can't just blame it all on Hiranyakashipu. Oh, extreme characters like that. Oh, my goodness. Hitler, Stalin, this one, that one. They ruined everything. But the everyday normal people with everyday normal desires to control and enjoy. So Kamsa presented his plan to Akrura. You see, I've got some wrestlers, Chandra and Mushtika, and I want Krishna and Balaram to wrestle with them. They like to wrestle in the forest of Vrindavan? Okay, I've got a wrestling match for them. I've got Kuvalayapid the elephant. Even before they get to the wrestlers, they'll get to Kuvalayapid the elephant, and the elephant will crush them. He had plan A, plan B, plan C, just like Hiranyakashipu thought he had it all figured out. And so then, Kamsa revealed to Akrura his master plan. You see, once I get rid of Krishna and Balaram, then I imprison Ugrasena. Vasudeva and Devaki are in prison. I'll kill this one. I'll kill that one. I make alliances with all the demoniac kings. We'll gang up together on the demigods and their representatives. And then I will be number one. And then he said something that revealed the essence of the Asarika Bhava. And that Asarika Bhava, that spirit of demoniac rebellion, also affects us. He said, when I'm in control of everything, it will be very pleasant to rule the world without any interference. This is actually an emotional expression. You can feel that welling up in us. It'll be very wonderful to have my way without any interference. This is sustainable happiness. No worry, as Freud said, no worry about other human beings, no worry about other species, no worry about the environment, future generations, just act on your sensual urges. According to Freud, that is the constitutional position of the living entity, but unfortunately, he said, you live in a civilization, you've got to check yourself, that means checking your happiness. Hiranyakashipu actually acted in that way. The Bhagavatam describes how he had no consideration for any rule or regulation. He was always intoxicated. That's considered to be a very high state these days. To be able to have such power and control and at the same time always be intoxicated. Nothing interfered with his will. Even Narada Muni was singing songs in praise of Hiranyakashipu. The functions of nature happened out of fear of Hiranyakashipu. The demigods were offering their obeisances to him, and Hiranyakashipu would take the demigod's share of the sacrificial yajnas. He'd take it all for himself. Nevertheless, although he was ruling the universe without obstruction, because Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu weren't interfering with him, he was completely dissatisfied, and his envy was unabated. He couldn't get it out of his system. This Vishnu killed my brother. And therefore, ultimately what's going to happen? His own son becomes a devotee of Vishnu. And this, you can't imagine what kind of rage it is. It's like if someone in your own family becomes a devotee of your worst enemy. Oh my goodness. What do you do? Think of the rage. You are my own flesh and blood. I put all my energies into raising you. I slave for you. I show patience for you. And now, not only are you siding with my worst enemy, you're a devotee of my worst enemy. When we think about things in this way, Hiranyakashipu doesn't seem so alien, you know? He seems kind of familiar. So, he's going to torture his own son. And amazingly, Prahlad always thought that in his father's attempts to torture him, his father was actually playing with him. Prahlad saw no animosity. He thought that my father is doing these things to play with me. He didn't take it in an inimical way. Nevertheless, of course, Prahlad understood my father is against the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We'll speak more tomorrow, but we'll stop here and ask any questions. Yes? The first part, please. That bhakti process does not put forth austerities for gaining mystic power or to become one with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Actually, pure bhakti is not even concerned with liberation from the material world. That's pure bhakti. Now, bear in mind, we're not going to, as I often explain, go around and find out which devotees are approaching Krishna for freedom from material existence. We don't have any secret police here that do things like that. There's nothing wrong with desiring to go back to Godhead to become free from material existence. Yet it is also so that pure bhakti is not concerned with becoming free from material existence, because as long as you're absorbed in devotional service, you actually have nothing to do with material existence. So the pure bhakti yogi is simply aspiring for devotional service, because then you're automatically already in the spiritual world. But Hiranyakashipu performed such excruciating austerities just for material power. I was speaking at our wonderful breakfast yesterday, speaking with His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj, and we were discussing various topics. And I was telling him how in the 70s, my office was right across the street above those garages there. And I got a chance to read all of Prabhupada's letters. This is long before there was a folio, but I also saw, and Maharaj was very astute to point out, you saw all the letters to Prabhupada, and not only did you just see the responses. So I was given the service of taking care of all the letters that were written to Prabhupada and letters Prabhupada wrote back. Our dear Romeshwar Prabhu, he gave me that service. He brought this huge box of letters into my office one day and said, "These are all Prabhupada's letters, both written to him and what he wrote back. Devamrita, you take care of them, and don't you read them." I didn't tell a lie. Yes, Prabhu, yes. And then as soon as Ramaswara Prabhu was out the door, Jayadweta was a brahmachari then, he suddenly emerges in my office, looks at the box and says, "Let's get into it." So we just read letters for like 2 years. The Sankirtan devotees would come from the airport and just immediately stop by my BBT office. Okay, let's hear some letters. So we're speaking about austerities. One devotee, he was a former leader in L.A. in the early 70s. He was the top manager, a very competent devotee. But he had some problems, as were common in those early days, too common. And he went away, but thank Krishna, he came back. He made an attempt to come back. And so he wrote this letter to Prabhupada that, "I've been in Maya and I have returned. Now I know exactly what would really reestablish me and help me to get the mercy again. I want to do something very austere. I need to go to a very austere place. Maybe like Vietnam." This is during the war in Vietnam. I need to take on challenging, excruciating situations that no one else can do. And that way, I'll show my sincerity and I'll reinstate myself if I take on some excruciating, super austere task." So he wrote that to Prabhupada. And he mentioned, "Well, maybe, the war in Vietnam, I can go there and preach on the front line," something like that. "That's very dangerous. The more dangerous and austere, the more mercy I'll get." And Prabhupada simply wrote back, "About your request to reinstate yourself and do something very challenging, austere, and excruciating, I simply request, why don't you attend the morning and evening program?" So, our bhakti austerities are sufficient. They are designed to attract Krishna's personal attention. They're not for building our material prowess. And at the highest level of bhakti, we are simply concerned with Krishna's pleasure. And that's not an austerity. Yes.
Maybe you can expand on this. You mentioned that Hiranyakashipu went and paid his obeisances and he was feeling some ecstasy, which was not pure ecstasy. So I just recall that one time a devotee told Prabhupada, in Prabhupada's memories, he was saying that, "Prabhupada, we had a great kirtan. It was so great. It was so good." And he was just going on and on. And Prabhupada reprimanded him and said, "The glorification of Krishna is not for your own pleasure. It's for Krishna's pleasure." So I was just thinking that sometimes in the name of devotional service, in our neophyte, endeavors, we have seen through the times that devotees, you know, many books may have been distributed, many temples have been opened, so many followers are there, and they're on and on, and they're, you know, like we can say we're doing something really good, and we experience some ecstasy, if you want to call it. So I was wondering if you can mention some the pitfalls or the dangers of in the spirituality, in the name of spirituality, feeling in that way, like almost in the same way as Yolanda Kashipu was feeling some ecstasy and it was not really pure.
Well, I don't think that we should compare impure bhakti to Hiranyakashipu. We all have to start somewhere. And by the inspiring example of real devotees, we become motivated to make advancement and serve Krishna purely. A great way to understand bhakti is to do something with all your might and it fails materially, and then you see that Krishna is pleased. And you're wondering, wait a minute, what I did didn't work out materially. Why is Krishna pleased? That's a great way to understand this point. According to your realization, of course, Yasya Prasada, Bhagavat Prasada, if the spiritual master is pleased, and Krishna is pleased, and the situation will get deeper and more intense according to your level of advancement and realization. Krishna's pleasure that he's pleased can be known through parampara, without a doubt. The greatest fear I find amongst devotees is that I'll do so much service, I'll surrender so much, but Krishna won't notice, and I won't feel that Krishna notices. Krishna has his own ways of making himself known to even a neophyte devotee. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, in one purport, I believe in the fourth canto, Srila Prabhupada writes that the personal care shown by Krishna is there even for the neophyte devotee at the beginning of his bhakti development. In some way, you're going to know that Krishna is present for me. And the so-called little things are extraordinary. Even just the taste of prasad, prepared with love and devotion, offered with love and devotion, you can taste that. That's tasting Krishna. When you hear the holy name in kirtan and in japa, you're seeing Krishna. You're experiencing Krishna. So bhakti means, to a great extent, understanding what you're actually already having. We're like a little kid with the most valuable gem in our hand, and we need to mature enough to understand what that gem is, which is already in our hand. Otherwise, if we don't know the value of the gem in our hand, what will a little kid do? He'll try to swallow it, throw it away, play marbles with it or something. So we already have the presence of Krishna, but we're not aware of it. And certainly, as we advance in bhakti, Krishna makes himself more present. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Rasaham apsukontaya, I'm the taste in water. So who here doesn't drink water? Supposedly, an adult is meant to have at least 2 liters or 2 quarts a day. So Krishna says, I'm the taste. I like the way Prabhupada dealt with that issue. He said, it's not that Krishna is speaking nice poetry. I'm the taste in water. You can actually experience him in this way. Now, granted, it's not the ultimate realization. But nevertheless, Krishna says, I'm the taste in water. That means you can get a Krishna experience that way. Love is always increasing in intensity. So we can't just throw out the precursor stages, the preliminary stages to love. They are very important also, those stages, as nectar devotion will present. At the same time, the love of the pure devotees for Krishna, what can match that intensity? The intensity is so great that even Krishna comes under its control. So we appreciate all levels of the bhakti process. We're not like, you know, on this trip of pure devotee or bust. Either I become immediately a pure devotee, otherwise I give up. Out into Maya I go because I couldn't achieve my version of Krishna's pleasure immediately. I tell the example, it's a true story. I was in the Brahmacharya Ashram in the Brooklyn Temple in New York in 73, and I went to sleep. We were all 100 brahmacharis in our sleeping bags on the floor. And as I went to sleep at 9 o'clock, I noticed there was one brahmachari pacing the floor, deep in thought. All right, so I went to sleep, and I woke up at 3 to get ready for Mangal Arati, and the brahmachari was still pacing the floor. I said, "You've been up all night. What's going on?" He said, "It's 1 hour now. It's 3:30. I got 1 hour before Mangal Arati. I've told myself, before the conch blows for Mangal Arati, I have to make a firm decision. Either I take sannyas or I get married." The true story. It's either what was in his mind as the ultimate, which is actually a great austerity, but he was considering this is the ultimate, I'll take sannyas, or else I'll get married. So it's one or the other. He had that conception that it's either what he considered to be ultimate success or it's, So we shouldn't be plagued by these considerations. We should understand that Krishna appreciates the endeavors of every devotee, just like a parent appreciates the progress of the little child speaking in broken language. Anything else? Yes?
Hare Krishna. Thank you for the class, Maharaj. Very nice class. I really like what you said about the happiness footprint and how our lives affecting other species. And I was wondering how, as devotees, we have a very nice life as vegetarian. We like to eat a lot of dairy products, but we know that at the same time, Krishna really cares about the cows, and what's going on with them is really causing a lot of suffering on the planet and causing a lot of future catastrophes. I wondered if you could say something about that.
Well, it's a very deep and pressing topic. I was discussing also with Soldier Radhanath Maharaj yesterday about how in the USA there are 9 million dairy cows. Now, what about the bulls? They're not around for a certain reason. And what about cows that are past their 4 years of suitable productivity as seen from a slaughterhouse perspective? Cows give milk 4 years. That makes profits worthwhile. And then, so the 9 million dairy cows present in the USA doesn't let you know the total number of cows or bulls that's been born. So, obviously, if you're concerned with your happiness footprint, you want to take all that into account. This topic about sustainable happiness and the happiness footprint is something, a concept I'm developing for university engagements, so please tolerate. But actually, this is bhakti at its full level. Sustainable happiness, happiness that considers all living entities, future generations, nature, the environment. Because, as Bhagavatam says, by watering the tree at the root, all the branches blossom. As Prabhupada writes in the beginning of Krishna book, bhakti is the simple process of loving everyone by loving Krishna. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.